You're listening to episode 8 of Conversations in the Gospel of John. This is the second series, and this series was recorded in the spring of 2024 in Wichita, Kansas, at French University. Welcome to the second season of Conversations in the Gospel of John. I'm here today with my co-host, Douglas Estes.
Hi, I'm Douglas. I was a pastor for 16 years, and now I'm a professor, and I focus on the Gospel of John as well as a number of other topics, but my current work is a 3-volume reception history of the gospel.
And I'm Stan Harstein. I've lately been working in 1 John, so it's a pleasure to come back and work in the Gospel of John now. We are recording these podcasts at Fringe University in Wichita, Kansas. We're grateful that you're listening to our conversation around the Gospel of John. Today, our guest is Blake Wassell. He is from Australia, so we'll be having a good time with vocabulary choices and other things, trying to get him to clarify some words that we might not have fully understood. But it's going to be a great conversation, looking at John 18 and 19. So, Blake, how would you like to introduce yourself to our audience?
Yeah, thanks, Stan and Douglas, for having me. Yeah, I'm Blake Wassell. I am in Australia. I did my PhD at the University of Otago, which is over in Aotearoa, New Zealand, with Paul Trebilco and James Harding. But I also had the help of Stephen Llewellyn, who'd been teaching me since my days at Macquarie University for my undergraduate studies, which was back here in Sydney before that. So I started in ancient history and languages. I went over to theology, and now I do a few different things at Australian Catholic University. We have a few campuses around Sydney. I teach in biblical studies. I work on our core curriculum, which is basically 2 big undergraduate units on social and global issues from Catholic perspectives, where we get students from all over the place in all the different courses that we offer at the university. So I'm very interested in contextual issues, whether it's modern slavery, whether it's acknowledgement of First Nations and peoples here, and the history of colonial violence in the last couple of centuries on the continent as well.
Well, we're glad to have you here today. So you also have a wonderful book that I just recently reviewed, just so everyone knows that we do have a relationship sometimes with these speakers, and enjoyed reading about the paradoxes in John 18 and 19. So the question we usually start with, so that we can help people realize that we come to John from different directions, is what caused you to be interested in the Gospel of John for the first time and to pursue such lengthy study into that gospel?
This isn't a straightforward answer. I'm not really sure what the answer is. I think there's a few factors. I grew up in the Salvation Army. One of the highlights of my early years was reading the Bible, reading kids' Bibles with my dad, going to bed at night. Then, you know, went to a really great university for studying early Christianity and Judaism. So I started studying New Testament from a historical perspective, I guess. And that was fascinating to me. But around that time, you know, looking at John's gospel again, in my early 20s, I didn't like Jesus a whole lot in John's gospel, not compared to the other gospels. I thought he was just a bit too obtuse and, you know, intentionally misleading and confusing people. He didn't read like a real person, or a, you know, fun to be around, fun to talk with kind of person. Everyone's confused, everyone's concerned, and he just annoys people and irritates them. And so I found Jesus a little bit difficult in John's gospel, but at the same time, very intriguing and very complex. And so he kept pulling me back, or the text kept pulling me back, I guess, maybe more so than the individual figure of Jesus in the narrative itself. And I thought, well, you know, coming from Macquarie University, where I did a lot on Rome and the ancient Roman world, I wanted to pursue these texts. They were appealing to me. And obviously, as the two of you both know well, this is a hugely important text. And so that's kept me with John's gospel. You know, the impact it's had for good and not over the years has kept me with it. So it's important historically, but it's also super ambiguous and puzzle prone, if you like. There's a lot to disentangle, a lot to experiment with when you're working through different aspects of the text.
That sounds wonderful. Plus, having the look that we're doing in the arrest and trial scenes and the relationship to the Roman Empire, that's something many pastors, Bible scholars, or Bible students don't get into. So we should have some interesting things for today. We've pulled up John 18 on our phones and that so we can follow along. But what right now, we're not necessarily worried too much about what you wrote in your studies, but right now, what is interesting you about this passage that you are intrigued about still and plying students with questions and investigating? What do you like to talk about right now from John 18 and 19?
At the moment, I'm thinking more about John's gospel as a whole and its potential relationship with Josephus, in particular, the Jewish war, and are Josephus and the author of John's gospel conveying similar senses of participation in the empire, maybe? Are they attempting to express a kind of Romanness, and for what reason, for what purpose? And there's a lot in my reading of John 18 and 19 that's kind of led me to those questions. But these are all kind of experimental hermeneutical comparisons. It's not like I wonder if, Josephus knew about John or vice versa, nothing like that. But otherwise, I still think, and this comes into the teaching side of things, as you alluded to, Stan, I think this passage is super important when we're thinking about both the Jewishness and the Romanness of John's gospel, and in positive and in negative senses.
And just as a clarification for those who may not be as familiar with Josephus, he was a general with the Jewish people and fighting in the war between 66 and 70, was captured and then returned to Rome with Vespasian, if I'm correct. I'm trying to pull my history out. But then he rewrote the Old Testament stories in one book, and then he talked about the war, and that's one of the very few sources we have of an eyewitness type of account. That's why we have these, and how do they fit when Rome is the empire, Rome is in charge, Rome has the power, those who oppose Rome are crushed, and how do you engage in that conversation? So, Douglas, what do you got?
Yes, so I think that folks who have listened to our podcast have a pretty good sense of what we mean when we talk about a literary approach. We're reading the New Testament, both recognizing its inspiration, but reading it from a story perspective. But can you explain in a really simple way what a Roman reading of John is all about?
Yeah, so to start with, like you say, you're reading the text as a text. Literary features, it works as a piece of literature. You're talking about plot lines, characterization, time, setting, all of these things. To put a Roman accent on all that, you're reading the text next to other texts from that period and from that part of the world, but you're also attuned to Roman tropes or symbols or characters, especially. I mean, that's a really obvious point. When you're looking at a character like Pilate, who's the prefect in Judea, when you see that the text mentions Caesar or the emperor, when you're looking at these different elements, you're looking at Roman elements. And how do you, try to discern what these elements are doing in the text? You go to similar texts dealing with the same elements and using the same elements in specific ways. So that's very broadly. You go for it.
I was just going to say, so I think if we were to put this down in a local church level, a pastor speaking on John 18 and 19, or maybe a small group meeting about John 18, 19, I think that if I were to say to the, and this is, I'm just going to have to speculate here, but if I were to say to somebody, think about the Jewish culture, I think a lot of people in churches are familiar with that phrase, right? Maybe that, the Jewishness of the New Testament. But if you say, no, think about this gospel in a Roman way, you're creating a cultural distinction. So what would be like one example of a Jewish cultural reading of John and a Roman cultural reading of John?
Wow, that's a big question, Douglas. Well, I mean, the two can coexist, right?
Of course. Maybe the nuances, because I'm thinking, like, Twitter established a couple months ago that men think about Rome. It was a big popular joke on Twitter, right? But when I think the average layperson thinks about Roman culture, it's probably just one or two stereotypical images, you know, perhaps of Caesar or the Roman legions or something they've seen on TV. But then, you know, bringing this back to scripture, there may be nothing that they can fill in the blank with when we say, hey, don't miss the Roman aspect of this.
And the other part, I think, to clarify is that when people think about Rome, even the empire, they just think about the city and all the things that they've seen. So what does it look like for a Roman province, right? The Roman-esque part of a provincial leading. And just clarifying that for those people who are listening.
Okay, great. Yeah, I think I'm with you. So I've got a couple of specific Roman things. One is when Jesus is clothed in purple. Purple is an imperial color. It can be a very contentious color. It symbolizes power and authority. Some emperors are very antsy about them being the only people allowed to wear purple. That's a specific Roman thing, which is there in the text in John 19. There's another way to go at it. It could be how Roman politics worked or legally. What are the kinds of ambiguities that we're working with around the empire? And one of the ones that I focus on in my research is, and that's really key, I think, to John 18 and 19, is how the empire works and how you get power and authority filtering down from Caesar. And it's to do with how kingship works. So I think it's important when you're reading the text, and this is, you know, in a very Jewish text like John's Gospel, the issue comes up in John 18 and 19, who's allowed to pronounce kings. And I think this isn't quite explicit or overt in the text, but this is part and parcel of how things work around the empire, that Caesar's the only one who's allowed to pronounce kings. And taking kingship for yourself or seizing kingship that isn't ratified by Caesar is a huge issue, and that's a crime. But that's the ultimate crime against Caesar. It's maestas. I'd say that's that kind of awareness of the way that our evidence for how things work around the empire can really help us to read a very clearly Jewish text dealing with intra-Jewish relations and disputes, such as in John's Gospel.
Let me add that, and this is my opinion, so you could take it for what it's worth, but I think that one of the Roman aspects of John 18 is the way Pilate questions Jesus. I think that gives us a snapshot of a very Roman perspective on prisoners and how we treat people and these sorts of things, their legal proceedings. That's always been my take anyway.
I mean, that's an example maybe from my perspective of something that, I mean, it might be Roman. It's Roman insofar as we're talking about a Roman character and he's in a position of Roman authority in Judea. But it's very strongly to me an instance of this is how the author is crafting their narrative. And the way that Pilate asks questions and kind of structures proceedings through chapters 18 and 19, it reminds me a lot of other parts of John's text and other parts of the text which are very Jewish. I think for me, John is so unique. It's kind of its own thing. And sure, it has Jewish color. Sure, it has Roman color. It has a lot of Greek color as well. And we read into it a lot of Christian color, of course. But it's Johannine.
Let's see if we can make this a little practical for ourselves and also for the audience in that regard. When we look at John 18, the first thing we're introduced to is in the NAS, they add the word Roman to identify the cohort. So they have the spera that's accompanying. And John's kind of unique in saying there was this kind of organization that was there. But then later on, they talk about the praetorium, which I don't know is necessarily discussed in the synoptics. I'm not doing a word search on that. But you have this little coloring that comes in, and then we have Pilate's discussion. It's almost like there's this backdrop of this is happening with some Roman power structure, perhaps. And then we get into the dialogue where you spend a lot of time of who declares the king. and the Latin word maiestas, which I think we get pretty easily a transliteration of majesty.
I want to keep going with what you said about the Praetorium, though, because I think that's really helpful to start with. Because John does make a big point of this being the Praetorium, and that's where Pilate is. This is a Roman location in Jerusalem, and it might be a temporary one, but you know that's where Pilate is. That's where Pilate runs things while he's there. What's interesting about the as you say, Stan, it's the Roman trial, at least in our you know our subheadings or our section headings in our translations. But what's unique in John 18 and 19 is that it's not just kind of a side note or an afterthought. Oh, this is where Pilate's involved, and wherever Pilate is, that's where it takes place. But it's emphatically the Praetorium, and Pilate is running things from inside the Praetorium and outside. And this is how you get the scenes being broken up. And you've probably got seven scenes. Most people see seven scenes, which are arranged pretty intentionally around the Praetorium. And this is totally unique to John. So in other words, the synoptics aren't doing this. But the Praetorium itself as a Roman location has kind of a governing structural role in this passage. So Jesus is, you know, inside with Pilate. Pilate goes outside, he comes back in, Jesus is back outside. And so there's a lot of this inside outside kind of movement. And it's all centered on the Roman location of the Praetorium. And Pilate himself is the agent. So he creates the structural role that the Praetorium has across the passage.
And that raises a question in my brain, is that would Pilate actually have gone in and out? I mean, here's the most powerful person in the area. Is he going to be, you know, being pushed back and forth between these two groups of people, trying to appease both sides? He's got the military on his side. He's got the power. Is he going to be doing the walking? Or is this actually a demonstration that Pilate's actually maybe not the one in charge? And so he's the messenger between these two parties, with one staying inside for most of it and the others on the outside. Just a thought that crosses my mind.
Yeah, it's interesting. Because John's gospel is prone to doing this. It blows things up that might already be in the synoptics, right? And there's a different scale of significance. And you just kind of get the sense that maybe this is part of the Roman flavoring of John's gospel, that, you know, this what's happening here is of imperial scale and significance. It's not some minor thing. This isn't just like your Jewish peasant kind of, you know, there's a bit of turmoil out there and this guy's involved and, you know, he gets crucified with a couple of others. No, like he's the center of everything, such that the prefects join in and the prefect has to do a lot of legwork in this trial, a lot more than in the other Gospels.
Which being a Roman part also, to my mind, points to the political aspects and political features of this particular pericope here in John.
For sure. You can see politically it's a very fraught, tense situation. There's a relationship between Pilate and Caesar at stake. There's a relationship between Pilate and the high priests at stake. The stability of the region at stake. John really cares about this moment or really cares about emphasizing the importance of this moment with Jesus. And historically, it might not have been the case that it was too important a moment. But of course, that's a different discussion, which I guess we'd say is not part of the literary discussion around how we interpret what's going on in the text.
Well, let's look at making this a little more practical. And let's talk about the kingship of Jesus. And so somebody's wanting to talk about this because this is going to be an Easter-ish past. What should they know about the proclamation, question, declaration, the placard on the cross declaring him as a Rex Basileus king? And what gets missed? What are the things that might be actually not just missed, but totally misread, perhaps, in talk about the king, the topic of kingdom?
Sure. Yeah. If we're zooming in on kingship, I think John's really unique in one particular way. John's Jesus is clearly a king in a very positive sense at different points in the narrative. And you get that toward the end of John chapter 18 as well. where Jesus talks about how he bears witness to the truth. This is essential to his kind of kingship. However, the titulus, or the titlos, so that John's written in Greek, so you have an instance of code switching, you'd say, because you take a Latin word, titulus, and then you give it in a Greek form, and then in our English translations, we usually have something like inscription. What did you say a moment ago, Stan?
Placard. That's also a placard.
Placard, yes. Something like that. So what's interesting about John's inscription is that there are two parts. Jesus is the king of the Jews, but he's also the Nazarene. Jesus the Nazarene, the king of the Jews. And this is unique to John's gospel. In fact, all four of the canonical gospels have a unique inscription. Of course, there are similarities, and Jewish kingship is a standard across them. But Jesus is the Nazarene, the king of the Jews. I think in John's gospel, not everyone thinks this, so take it with a grain of salt, but I think when the inscription or the titulus labels Jesus as king of the Jews, it's actually referring to the false accusation against Jesus. So in other words, this is the lie brought by the Jews to Pilate that Jesus has made himself a Jewish king, and in brackets, without the say-so of the emperor, without any imperial ratification, Jesus has gone out there and claimed authority for himself. That's the lie. That's the false accusation. And you have that intriguing Jesus the Nazarene as well, which is, I think, the positive Christological piece, if you like, of the inscription. So this is who Jesus is. And I followed the work of another Aussie Johannine scholar, Mary Collo, who argues that the Nazarene signals in a very subtle and nuanced way that Jesus is a temple builder or temple restorer, which would then take us back to John chapter 2, where Jesus said, you know, if you destroy the temple, I'll rebuild it in a few days. So there's this temple Christology through the way that John portrays the figure of Jesus in the narrative. And so I think those two elements sit side by side in a little bit of tension. Jesus, who's really the temple builder, Jesus, who's not really the king of the Jews, that's the lie. That's the false accusation against him.
All right, so let me ask this. Short answer, quick answer round. If you were stopped by one of your students who said, hey, I'm going to be speaking on this in my small group or going to be doing a sermon on this, okay, what is one thing that people miss? Because this is a commonly taught passage because of Easter. So some of the passages we've dealt with in John are not as commonly discussed. But this one's very commonly discussed. What is the number one thing that you think might be missed in a typical discussion of this?
Well, the number one thing, I think, and you just alluded to this passage a moment ago, Douglas, it does pick up on what's happened in John chapter 8, which is potentially one of the most violent and infamous New Testament texts that we've got. Jesus does call some of those Jews in that episode the devil's children, because they want to lie and murder just like their father. I think this episode in John 18 and 19, I think it's the moment where they show, you know, this is who we are. There's a false accusation there, and ultimately they're responsible for the death of Jesus. And there are little hints and ambiguities in the text that it's possible to read the Jews as the ones actually taking Jesus to be crucified there in John 19, 16, which would then support, I think, what you see in John 8, 28 as well. Jesus tells some Jews that they're the ones who'll exalt the Son of Man, and that will be a moment of revelation for them. Something that's really important to catch there, but not maybe commonly caught, is that it does pick up on that really negative characterization of Jews who don't accept Jesus in this particular narrative.
Right. We had talked with, when we talked with Andy Byers earlier, you know, he emphasized the importance of, or one of the things that's lacking, and therefore the importance of reading back through the text to really understand the current, you know, passage that you're dealing with. And I think that's a great example of John 8 here, pointing towards John 18 and 19. And so when we're reading 18, 19, you know, we got to go back to 8. Now, I'm just going to say my opinion, but I think that also one thing that I read here is that the Jews, the Judeans that are really attacking Jesus, especially by 18 and 19, it's kind of a small politically charged group, it feels like to me. I mean, we're not talking about the whole population in my mind, of Jerusalem here. We're talking about a small politically motivated group who really feel like they want to take Jesus out. You know, I read that from the Caiaphas passage. To me, that's like one of the most important statements in the gospel.
Yeah, I mean, and you've got in John 19, the mentions of the priests. The priests are very separate from from the whole Jewish population, even, you know, the people in Jerusalem. I mean, this is a huge debate, as you both know. The translation debate is Jews or Judeans, you just alluded to that. And there are reasons for going for either option. Theologically, I think it's a different discussion again to the historical one. Historically, obviously, we wouldn't be talking about all Jews, I think. But the text is doing its own theological thing. And there is this kind of, I think the group's a bit amorphous. Like, you do get, you know, the Jews mentioned in one moment, then the Pharisees, then the priests, and it's not always clear how to track, you know, who exactly is involved here. John really cares about if you're accepting and trusting Jesus or not. And, you know, the dualism is so pivotal. It's not just dualism, though, is it, Douglas? It's paradox, right? Because you've got... I should say as well that Douglas is a big part of why I've become interested in paradox and not just settling for dualism between, for example, light and darkness or belief and unbelief. But these sets of poles, you see them working together in tandem, and that's a key part of what John's gospel is trying to do.
If I can interject, one of those things of, we may not be talking so much about, you know, a judgment on the Jews or the leaders of the Jews, but based on what you said earlier in the work of Mary Kahlo, we're talking about, it's a battle for the temple. And so the people who are responsible for the temple are the ones who are really upset about Jesus. As you mentioned, it goes back to chapter 2, but there's this temple figure. And when you talk about the title, Jesus the Nazarene, I mean, if he's the temple builder, then that really does focus it, that it's a question about where does, you know, God dwell? And that becomes a bigger picture. So, but we had a great conversation. Need to wrap it up because
we've reached that point.
We've reached that point. So we've appreciated your Romanesque taking that seasoning and throwing it into the Gospel of John. Do you have any final words for our audience as we get ready to close, Blake?
No, thanks for having me, Stan and Douglas. Nice to chat.
And Douglas, any final thoughts to clarify all that's been said and done today?
No, yes, I do like what Blake said about, you know, if we give a hat tip to Harry Attridge's view of genre being a multicolored coat in the Gospel of John, you also have the same scenario with flavoring. You have, as Blake mentioned, Roman flavoring, Greek flavoring, Jewish flavoring. I think there's a fourth one in there somewhere. But, you know, you have all these different flavorings, and it's one of the things that makes John so unique.
Douglas and I would like to thank you for joining us on Conversations in the Gospel of John. Our next guest will be Janie Clark Soles from Perkins School of Theology at SMU in Dallas, Texas. Bye now.